Jerry, it's can you go by Jerry or Gerald?
Jerry.
Jerry, it's nice to meet you. I'm Chip Michaud. I'm 55 years old. Today I'm in my office at in Bedford, Massachusetts. I live in Tyngsborough, Massachusetts, which is just northwest of here, a little bit. It's generally northwest of Boston. And the relationship is you, this is my first meeting with you, and looking forward to our discussion.
Great. My name is Gerald Reed. I go by Jerry Reed. I'm 68 years old. I'm at my home in Wallingford, Connecticut. We've lived here in Wallingford for 35 years, but I'm from Massachusetts originally. And so I'm here at my home and I'm talking with Chip, who's my one small step partner in this conversation. So I guess I'll start with the first question, Chip, if that's okay. And yeah, I guess we've already talked a little bit about why we wanted to do this interview. I think we shared that point that I felt that there's not enough of these kinds of conversations amongst people who don't know each other and who and not knowing each other don't know what the other's person's experiences and perspectives are. My own experience has been that when I do meet people, such as that RV vacation that we were just on, that I was telling you about before we started recording, once a person someone has an opportunity to talk to someone and get to know their own experiences and kind of talk face to face, whether in person or virtually, they discover a lot about themselves and about the other person. And I guess are more open to other points of view. And so that's what intrigued me about this whole project. As I said, I was familiar with StoryCorps. I listened to the StoryCorps interviews on NPR often. And I was really intrigued by this project. I think that there's just too little of this kind of conversation going on, and our country desperately needs this kind of conversation. And there seem to be all kinds of obstacles to those kinds of conversations these days. So that's why I'm interested in having this conversation.
Yeah, I'm here for very similar reasons. I've traveled some, and I've enjoyed meeting other people and getting into conversations and hearing different points of view. And most of the time, I learn something. I learn something, maybe generally, but also about myself. And very intrigued by other people's views. I also think at this, I'm 55 years old, and it seems like at this time in our country, it seems like we're very divided on a lot of things. And I think if we had more conversations like this, we could meet, somewhere in the middle ground. But it's, especially if I look at politics, it's like it's either you're on this side or that side, and there's no in between. And I think we need a lot more of the in between to continue to have, a great country.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that last point that you just made, that if we can, it's in recent years it's been so hard to find a common ground, and for even people to talk to one another to try to find some common ground. That's one of the reasons that I had wanted to do this, that it seemed struck me as a way to bring people to trying to find some common ground, and there just doesn't seem to be enough of that kind of effort these days on both sides, right, of the political divides. Should I go? I guess I'll go ahead and read Chip's bio, and maybe I'll ask you a couple of questions about that, Chip. So Chip's a 55-year-old male. He was born and raised in Massachusetts and still lives there. He's the oldest of five children. Was raised by a single mother, and times were tough. They struggled with the basics of food, heat, electricity, and housing, but they found their way, found good jobs, paid their way through college. They feel both proud and lucky for their lot in life. He believes that hard work is important to success and happiness. I'll come back to the last point because I agree with that, but I'll come back to that one in a bit. So where in Massachusetts were you born, Chip?
So technically I was born in Boston, but I grew up on the South Shore of Massachusetts in Rainham, which I don't know if you know where Rainham is, but do you know where Taunton is?
Yeah, sort of. As I mentioned, I'm from Massachusetts originally, grew up in Massachusetts, but in the western part of the state. Right. It's not a big state, as you know, but it seems like people from the western part of the state don't know much about people on the other, in eastern Mass and vice versa. Right. We grew up knowing the Boston Red Sox and Fenway Park and Cape Cod.
And for those of us on the eastern part of the state, it was like anything west of Worcester was, wild country, right?
Yes. Yep. And so I know roughly the area that you're talking about. And both of our kids went to college in Boston. So we became, later in life, my wife's from Massachusetts as well. We became much more familiar with the eastern part of the state later in life when our kids were going to school up in the Boston area. I'm really intrigued by your family story. You grew up with a single mom.
Yeah.
What did she do for work?
She was an RN.
Uh-huh. And she raised five kids.
Five kids, yep.
Yeah. I mean, you make reference to it here, but that must have been, and that was in the Boston area or somewhere there in eastern Massachusetts.
Yeah, it was Rainham. It's about 30 miles south of Boston.
Okay. And you went to, I'm assuming, you went to public schools, public elementary school, high school, and
we went to Rainham schools, and then Rainham being a small town, we had we went to a high school that was with another town, so we went to Bridgewater Rainham High School.
Okay, yeah, all right. Then you worked your way through college.
Yes.
Where did you go to college?
So I went to UMass at Dartmouth, which is again on the South Shore of Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So I went there. I went there and got a degree in management. I worked summers I did construction work full time in the summer and almost full time the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. And I was also in the Army Reserves. So that helped me fund college and living expenses while I was going to college. I also went back to school a few years later to get another degree in accounting. And then my last degree, I went to Boston University for my MBA. Mm-hmm.
Great. Wow. That's impressive. and what about you said you were one of five. Did they all go on to college? The other four brothers and sisters, did they go on to college as well?
So three of us did. One, he has a college wasn't something for him, but he's done very well. He drives a truck. He actually for Stop and Shop. So he drives for them. He's doing very well. And I have one sister who's disabled. developmentally, so she couldn't go to college. My two sisters, they both went to college. One is a teacher. She teaches elementary school. And then I have another sister who has her doctorate in nursing and currently is a professor at the University of North Georgia.
Wow. Great. That's great. So it must have been, I guess, doubly difficult for your mom, not just great raising the five of you, but with your sister who was developmentally delayed, that must have been a real challenge.
Yeah. It's one thing raising kids with no money, but then when you have one has challenges, it makes it that much more.
Yeah. I was raised by a two parent family, but also raised in a situation where there wasn't much money, but it was just the two of us. My wife's an elementary school teacher and taught special ed for many, many years when we were first married. We were still living in Massachusetts at the time. So, I mean, I don't know what the issues were with your sister, but I certainly have an appreciation for what that means, both for the parent or parents, but also for the teachers that find themselves in that situation. So, your mom must have been a really hardworking, great woman.
Yes.
I guess the last thing I might have some other questions about your bio, but I do agree with the last point. I believe you say hard work's important to success and happiness. I would agree with that completely. I would add that one of the keys to success is of taking advantage of good opportunities that come your way. So I would add that into the mix of hard work, taking advantage of opportunities when they come your way.
Yes, I fully agree with that. I've been fortunate that some opportunities have come my way. And I know that there's probably some I missed on, but there are some that, when I was looking at schools to do my MBA, it's pretty expensive. And, I was working around Boston and I wanted to go to school in Boston. And, a MBA at Boston University, when I went, cost $100,000. And I'm like, there's no way I could do that. But because I had all this time in the Army Reserves, I had access to the GI Bill, mm-hmm. which was an opportunity that presented itself, which allowed me to, pursue my MBA at Boston University, which I might not have been able to if it wasn't for that.
Yeah. What kind of responsibilities did you have in the Army Reserve?
So I was 25 years in the Army Reserves. I started as a communication specialist. So I did things like, radios, telephones, computers, setting them up, maintaining them in the field. I was with a combat support hospital. And then as I moved up in rank, I moved up to the position of first sergeant, which basically meant I was responsible for the health and well-being and morale and discipline and training of, everybody in my unit, mm-hmm. sure they were fed, housed, where they were supposed to be, when they were supposed to be doing their soldier training, I wasn't responsible for their specialty training. I really enjoyed it. The camaraderie and getting to know people from all over, at different times, I get to meet people from all over the world. And I'll never forget, I went to basic training when I was between my junior and senior year in high school, and I hadn't been pretty much out of southeastern Massachusetts. And, it was very interesting to meet people from all over the country, different walks of life, and it was very instructive.
Wow, great. Great.
So I think it's, unless you have more questions, Jerry, I think it's time for me to.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
So Jerry, you're a 68-year-old college professor, married with two grown children, one grandchild, originally from Western Massachusetts, where your father was a farmer and a plumber, and mother was a housewife and office worker. The matter of growing economic inequality is especially important to me, as I think it underlines so many of the key issues in our society. I'm sure we have some similar experiences. So maybe you could tell me a little bit of what it's like to grow up on a farm.
Well, it was, I don't remember a lot of it because my dad got out of farming when I was still very young. He grew up on farms himself in Western Massachusetts, in Deerfield, Massachusetts. That's a place from Eastern Mass. Some people sometimes know Deerfield, Massachusetts. But he was actually, when I was born, he was actually managing a dairy farm. And his dream had been to own his own dairy farm. But he was managing a dairy farm until I was in a little town called Leiden, Massachusetts. That's where we were. It's right below the Vermont border, right below Brattleboro, Vermont, on the Vermont border. It's a little town. Back then, it was probably 500 or 600 people. Today, it's about 800 or 900 people. It's a really tiny little town. And he managed a dairy farm. And as I said, with the dream of owning his own farm someday. And when I was about 4 or 5, they actually looked in, they made an effort to get a bank loan and to buy a farm in town or near the town where we were living at the time there in Western Massachusetts. And the bank turned them down for the loan. And my mom always said, I don't remember this at the time because I was only 4 or 5 years old, but my mom always said after that, it was the best thing that ever happened to them, that they didn't get the loan, because it was a really tough life. It was 24/7, 365 days a week, because it was a dairy farm and they could never go anywhere.
Right.
And that, in addition to where we lived at the time, was very hilly country, and you couldn't grow to the size of making it profitable. My dad talked about this later, when I could understand this, but a lot of the dairy farms were going out of business at the time. This is in the mid to late 50s. And you just couldn't get to the scale you needed to get to stay profitable.
Right.
And so that, combined with the fact that it was just so hard, it was such hard work, and they had done it for 5 years, that my mom was relieved that they got out of farming. And so my dad eventually got into plumbing. He was kind of like a plumber's assistant, was an apprentice, got licensed as a plumber, and then did that for a good portion of my childhood. And we moved to Greenfield, Massachusetts, which is mostly where I grew up. And that's really the growing up that I remember, was there in Greenfield, Massachusetts. My dad eventually became a plumber. Later in life, became involved selling plumbing and heating supplies for a web company. That's probably a name that you're familiar with, FW Yes. Web Company. I know it's popular there in the Massachusetts area. And he was sort of in plumbing and heating sales for most of the rest of his later working life. So I grew up in Greenfield, Massachusetts, went to public schools in Greenfield, Massachusetts, eventually went on to UMass Amherst, which is half hour south of where I grew up. I went from a town of about 10,000 to a campus of about 25,000. It was like a different world.
Yeah.
And also, I guess this is something that we share. I worked my way through college partly as a plumber's assistant, because my dad's connections in the plumbing, with plumbers in our local area, he was able to get me part-time jobs during the school year and full-time jobs in the summer working as a plumber's assistant. I finished college in 1976. I thought I wanted to be a social worker, And my junior year in college, I spent the entire junior year in college in a volunteer program working in Worcester, Massachusetts, by the way. And I was basically a youth counselor. And it was a great experience, but one of the values of an internship is that you learn maybe what you don't want to do. And I learned I did not want to be a social worker. I wasn't cut out for it. And the only other courses I had enjoyed while I was in, the other courses I really enjoyed in addition to my sociology and social work courses were anthropology courses. And so I decided to change my major to anthropology. I didn't, you know, for better or for worse, I didn't ever really think about it as, oh, what kind of a job am I going to get after college with this degree, you know? It was something I was interested in. And during my final year at UMass, I think one of the questions that's on our list here is an influential person. One of my college professors, who was an excellent teacher, really inspired me and encouraged me. And I could see myself in that role. I could see myself in that position, or hoped I could be in that position to be a college professor. So I graduated from UMass Amherst, took a year or two off working in the Amherst area, and then eventually went to graduate school in anthropology in Chicago, which was, I had never been in a big city before, really, except Boston to see the Red Sox. And so that was an interesting experience. And then eventually back to UMass Amherst for my PhD in anthropology. And when I finished there, my wife, who was an elementary school teacher at the time, we had just had our first child, and she wanted to be at home with her for some time. So she wanted to take a leave from her job. I was offered a job, not a teaching job, a different kind of a research job sort of in Connecticut. That's what brought us to Connecticut. And about a year after we had moved down here, I had been looking for teaching jobs. A job opened at a place called Sacred Heart University, which is in Fairfield, Connecticut. And I got that job, and now it's 34 years later. So that's a good chunk of my life story in a nutshell.
Yeah. So it's interesting. My wife is a social worker. So she has her master's in social work, and she works for the Department of Children and Families in Massachusetts. So, I can understand why it's certainly not a job that I'm cut out for. I am very proud of her and how she handles it, but it's a tough job. And you're gonna have a lot of patience, you're gonna have thick skin, but she does. So
yeah, I think kind of looking back on it, that's why maybe I couldn't see myself, but at the time, it's just that I couldn't envision myself in that role. I just didn't think I was very good at it for whatever reasons. Or at least it was stressful, and I couldn't imagine that kind, you know, working for the rest of my working life doing that kind of work. Yeah. My wife, as I said, she started out as a special ed teacher, then became an elementary teacher, and then ended up her career. She retired about a year and a half ago as a reading specialist, but always working with young kids, kindergarten age, first grade age. And it takes incredible patience there as well. And she works a lot with social workers because she was often working with students who are developmentally delayed, sometimes sometimes that had to do with a personal history or there was some kind of physical or mental disability, but often it was kind of just family situations. These kids were way behind their peers. Yeah. And so it was a tough job and required a lot of patience as well.
There's something else that you mentioned that reminded me of my life experience is when you graduated from college or you were getting close, figuring out what kind of actual job or career that would lead to. Mm-hmm. That's why I have two bachelor's degrees, because I thought I would go to school and get a degree in management, and then somebody would hire me as their CEO, and I'd have the big corner office and make all kinds of money. But then I quickly realized that with no experience, you know, I wasn't getting that job. And yeah. I had the jobs I got were not great jobs. I managed convenience stores, that like a dairy farmer. It was a, you know, 24/7, 365 days a year job, where, you know, because the stores were open and I had to make sure they were open, and paying people $7 an hour. Sometimes they just didn't come to work, and I had to make sure the stores were open. So I went back to school to get my accounting degree.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up in the career that I've been in for the last 28 years.
You know, when I finished graduate school, I had no idea what the job market would be like. Well, I shouldn't say I had no idea what the job market for anthropologists would be like. I knew it wouldn't be good. I knew that there weren't lots of jobs out there. You don't see many advertisements for anthropologists, right? But I was in a department at UMass Amherst that had a graduate program. And so I saw graduate students around. I got to know some of those graduate students. And as I said, had a really inspiring and really effective professor as an undergraduate. And that was sort of what led to the decision. When I finished my graduate program in 1987, the job market was not good. There was a lot of cutbacks going on in higher education, especially in the social sciences and humanities. It was expanding in things like engineering and business and things like that. And I got offered a job in New Haven, Connecticut, and it gave us the opportunity to move and for my wife to take a year off to be with our daughter. I think it's an example of what I was saying before about taking advantage of an opportunity that comes your way. It wasn't by any means the ideal job. I wanted a teaching job. I didn't want this research job, but it was a start, and it put me in position to be teaching part-time at this university called Sacred Heart University, which was about a half hour away. And during the course of that year, luckily for me, a full-time job opened up, and I applied for that job and I got the job. I had always kind of envisioned myself at a large university, kind of like UMass. That was my experience, right?
Mm.
And I ended up at a small, private, liberal arts, Catholic college. It was small then. It's much larger now. It's grown tremendously in size over the last 30 years. But it wasn't what I had envisioned, but it was a place to start. And as it turned out, it was a good place for me. I'm still teaching. And I'm about to start. I think it's my 35th year there at that 34th year at that university. It's not what I had imagined the kind of place I would be, but it was the right opportunity came along at the right time, I guess. And I tried to take advantage of it. I mentioned one of my most influential persons. I found that a very difficult question to answer, by the way. to choose one. I'd have to start listing them. Like I mentioned, a college professor. Another one would have to be my own mom and dad. I mean, they were incredibly hard workers, and I don't think they ever understood what anthropology was, or why I wanted to do it, but. They knew that it was exciting to me and that I was willing to work hard at it. And I think that's the part that they appreciated, that I worked hard. So it would be hard for me to come up with one person. There would be a list of people, each important for different reasons.
Yeah, I could certainly give you a list of people that have been very influential in my life. But you know, we've been talking a lot about our careers and how we get to where we are today. So one person I could think of is when I was deciding that I didn't want to manage convenience stores, or I worked in auto parts stores, and I worked in automobile service centers, and the jobs were, it was very stressful, little control, low pay, and I would manage people, and I couldn't really pay them what I think we should have been paying them. Mm. But anyways, I needed to get out of that industry. And so I went back to school. While I was going back to school to get my degree in accounting, I was trying very hard to get a job in accounting. And this is pre-internet day. So I looking through the Boston Globe Sunday Help Wanted section, I didn't get a lot of traction, but I did get an interview for a very entry-level accounting position at a company in Quincy. And, you know, fortunately it was between me and another person, and that other person bowed out. So I get the job. Yeah. And the CFO of that company recognized that, you know, I wanted to be an accounting professional. And she was very supportive along the whole way, understanding that I would go to school two nights a week, had to leave work early, but I always worked hard and got my work done and took on more. And she continued to support me, you know, and mentor me as I was going through that. And while I finished my degree, I took the CPA exam and I passed. And she came to me and she said, "You passed the CPA exam. You need to go and work in public accounting because you need 1,000 hours of public accounting to get your license." She's like, "We don't want to lose you, but we want to make sure that you continue to build your career." Mm-hmm. And she's like, "I know some people, the controller here knows some people. So let us set up, you know, let's make some introductions for you and see if we can't get you a job in public accounting." And I ended up getting a job in public accounting. And I was older. Typically in public accounting, they hire people right out of college. And that's how you start in public accounting. There's really no other way in. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, I was probably 30, maybe even a little older than that. And people would come to me, they're like, how are you here as just starting in public accounting and you didn't just graduate from college? So if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have been able to do that. And even, you know, that's 22 years ago, even today, I still keep in contact with her.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great.
She's still there if I need advice and so forth. So she told me that, you know, while we may be successful in our individual careers and lives, that, you know, if you see people that are willing to put in the effort, you should do whatever you can to help them to continue to reach their goals. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've tried to do since then.
Wow, that's a great story.
Thank you.
That's a great story. I get it. It sounds to me like, again, another example of taking advantage of opportunities and that come your way. One of the things I don't know how we're doing for time, but I want to make sure we get to that fourth question. I'd be happy to talk some more about influential people in my life. But maybe we'll talk a little bit about the fourth question and we'll see. Okay, we have about 20. Okay, great. Thank you. I guess, you know, I found it actually when we had to fill out that pre-survey thing, I found it a little bit difficult to answer a few of those questions because I don't find myself on one place on the political spectrum on all issues. I guess I would generally describe myself as being somewhat left of center on a lot of issues. And I mentioned the issue of, I think that the issue of economic inequality is a really important issue in our society. And that is actually one of the factors that underlies a lot of the divisiveness that we see in our society today. And so I guess on that particular issue, I'm sort of on the progressive side in terms of the ways of trying to address that issue. But I find that my thinking about that is very complicated because there are some, I guess, traditional sort of right of center values that I think are really important, such as hard work, for example, right? So I find it very difficult to place myself at one particular point on the political spectrum on even any given issue, because I think these are complicated. I guess I'm generally more in favor of government efforts to try to address some of the social and economic problems in our society. But I have concerns about people who go too far in that direction, partly because I'm not sure that I would want to go that far, but also I find that people that really go far on that perspective, on the spectrum to the left, are actually contributing to this divisiveness and the lack of an effort to try to find some kind of common ground. Because as strongly as I might feel about particular policies and issues, I recognize that there are other people who have very different points of view, and that the only way that we can move forward and succeed as a country is to find some way to compromise, to find some way to find common ground. And I find that often people who are too far to the left are unwilling to engage in that kind of conversation, just as people too far on the right, at least from my perspective, are.
Yeah, I think we're a good match. Jerry, you and I'm probably considered just right of center. Mm-hmm. I think the government should do what it can to help people be successful. But I think people need to take responsibility, personal responsibility. And I'm not saying that people left of center don't think people need to do that, but you know, I think if you go too far left, you know, from my perspective, I hear things like guaranteed minimum incomes and stuff like that. And I think, you know, that can be dangerous, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. I think there's tremendous opportunity for especially young people in this country. I think you and I had both been on the job market when it was a lot harder to find a job than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people today are unwilling to take the entry level jobs and do the work to get to the next level. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when I was a teenager and I need to get a job, and somebody told me McDonald's wasn't even hiring them. You know, mm-hmm. I'm getting a job at McDonald's. You had to know somebody to get a job at McDonald's. Somebody told me, just go once a week and ask to talk to the manager and just keep going. And I did that for a couple of those places, and I ended up getting a job at Kentucky Fried Chicken when I was a teenager. But, you know, if you say that to somebody today, that, you know, first of all, they don't want to work there, right? I think, you know, one thing I did in an effort to give back is actually through this person that I met, this the influential person. Later in life, she took a job at a nonprofit as the CFO. The nonprofit is called Year Up, and they're headquartered in Boston, but they have locations throughout the United States. And what they do is they take young adults, that may have graduated from high school or are close to, being able to do their GED, and puts them through a training program that teaches them professional skills. They have accounting, IT, and sales as three different programs that they can choose from. And then they get them an internship. And then a lot of them end up going to college after this. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting, a lot of the things that they taught them is they had to show up professionally dressed for class every day. You know, maybe not a suit and tie, but definitely a buttoned up shirt, maybe a jacket. They had to be on time, and they were penalized for being 1 minute late. Mm-hmm. They had to be respectful when they talked to each other. They had to, learn how to communicate better. And I was just very impressed about that program, and that's where I think the government can help. Mm-hmm. This is a not-for-profit, totally relies on donations, but more programs like that to teach people how to be successful, mm-hmm. Is something that I think the government can do.
You think that the government can do?
Yes. Yeah. By supporting organizations and programs like that. Mm-hmm. I think City Year is another program I'm not as familiar with, but I think that's another program where, the government support of that is well suited. I think, your dad was a plumber, and I think, there's tremendous opportunity in the trades that, not everybody needs to go to and get a bachelor's and a master's and a PhD. I know electricians and plumbers that live a very good life. They still had to go to a lot of training and learn a skill, but it's maybe not a bachelor's degree, but, I think supporting more people to go into those kind of trades, which there's definitely a lack of, there's a lot of open positions in those trades where they can't find people who want to be, a journeyman,
Right.
And a helper, a journeyman to on their way to become a master plumber, mm-hmm. a master electrician, a master carpenter. I think we can help in that way as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I would agree with you about the importance of trades and that's the right route. For a certain number of people, growing up in a real working class family, but then kind of now, I mean, my own family, my own nuclear family, we're all college educated. My kids are college educated. I spend my work days with people in a college setting, right? So it's kind of like my whole world. And so I'm sure that colors my perspective, but it seems to me that one of the difficulties is maybe that in kind of promoting the trades is that, first of all, I don't know that there are sufficient number of programs to train people for that work. I just don't have a good sense of that, right? But I think that there's such an emphasis in our society today on a college education. And I think, in many ways, for appropriate reasons, I think college is useful beyond the career that it prepares you for. My wife and I have this discussion all the time: is college just about career, or is college training for work? Is it training for citizenship? All of those sorts of things. I'm firmly in the latter category. I have a very sort of liberal arts orientation to college education. But I find even with the parents of our students, as well as other parents that I meet right here in our neighborhood, that there's this perspective that the only real route to success is through college. And that may, and I think that that's, so number one is that's a hurdle to overcome to encourage people to go into the trades, right? When even your parents and your teachers are talking about the importance of a college education, we hear that all the time. I think that that's something that has to be dealt with. Funding for those kinds of training programs, but funding also for college level programs to prepare people for alternative kinds of careers, I think are really important. And I think in this, kind of tie this back to the matter of economic inequality, I think the cost of college education and it is such an impediment to many families, especially if they're sort of at the lower end of the economic spectrum. As I said, I'm an advocate for college education, not just for career, but for preparation for life and for citizenship. I think that needs to be made more affordable. Even a community college education, I think, is really important. So I think that's, I guess, maybe part of what I'm saying is I'm agreeing with your point that there needs to be, that's a role that government can play. And I just, yeah. I would extend that to the, to making college education more affordable.
I agree with you that there's a lot more to learn in college than a profession. I'm considered myself fortunate that, you know, as I was going through, especially my bachelor program, you know, there was a, you know, there, I had to take, you know, certain liberal arts courses. I had to take, you know, but I had some flexibility in it. And I would say it was a mix of history and sociology. And I think it did prepare me to be a better citizen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's, maybe I would be, probably wouldn't be, but, you know, maybe I think there's a lot of ignorance in this country on the ends of the spectrum, right? Where I think if you really study sociology and really study history, you can bring that to be a better citizen. Mm-hmm. You know, to understand that there were times when Democrats and Republicans worked together, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that there were, you know, the labor struggles that we've gone through in this country, you know, the racism that existed in this country, you know, and how far we've come, though we need to continue, right? Mm-hmm. And understanding that, you know, not everybody had a fair chance, right? Mm-hmm. But if you don't understand that, you know, it makes it hard to be. I think one of the things that I've seen is some community colleges where they prepare somebody for a trade, but then they also have to be, they have to get an associate's degree, right? So that they are getting exposure to some of these other areas that you typically get in college education.
That's really interesting. I haven't heard of anything like that. That's a really interesting idea. I'm gonna Google that. See if I can find out more about it. You were mentioning the extremes of the political spectrum, and there seems to be kind of an ignorance on both ends of that maybe a good college education can help to address. I think also kind of along with that idea that the problem, one of the problems that we face with these extreme ends of the spectrum is not just an ignorance, but an unwillingness to talk to people who are someplace yeah. else on the political spectrum. And I think that's also one of the, I haven't thought this through entirely, but my thinking is that's one of the things that a good college education can do, is it can open you up to different points of view. I mean, I went to a large public university where we had a range of people. UMass Dartmouth, I'm sure, was very similar, right? Yeah. There were people like, you know, kids of plumbers and farmers like myself, right? And then there were folks from, a lot of folks from Eastern Mass who were from the big city, you know, and had parents who were working in white collar jobs and things like that. And that combined in kind of spending time in a dorm and in a classroom, talking about whatever the subject was, if it's history or sociology, it kind of opens you up, I think, to a greater willingness to listen to other people. So I think that's one of the other values of a college education. That said, I know that there are people on both ends of the extremes, right and left, who have very good college educations.
Yes, they do. Yes.
So it's not the only solution, but I think it's one part of the solution.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I took a sociology class in my undergraduate, and I remember the first class, and somebody came to add the class, you know, during that add drop period. And the professor asked, "What college are you in?" You know, the College of Business and Industry. It's like, you can't add my class. He's like, he was a self-professed communist, you know, and believed that capitalism was the root of all evil. But I was in his class already. I took the class. I learned a tremendous amount, and I got an A. I never told him that I was in the College of Business. It's interesting that he would not have let me in.
Yeah.
Had he realized that.
Yeah.
But
it's a funny story, first of all, but it's an unfortunate for that other student. I had professors like that, but I have to say that for all, I think that sometimes, I guess higher education college professors get a kind of stereotype as sort of left-leaning, too far left-leaning liberals. Yeah. My experience has been, there are certainly folks like that, but most people are, you know, somewhat to the left of center, some to the right of center. I think that there aren't a lot of people on those far ends of the spectrum, but those are the ones that you read about in the news or that you hear the stories about. Most people I find, even if they have a set political values and beliefs, they don't bring that, they ought not to be bringing that in the classroom, right? All that does is get in the way of the learning of the students, right? I mean, if they hold different views that are different from your own, they shut down. And if you force those views on them, they shut down. That's been my experience. And I think most of the college teachers that I know work hard to keep that out of the classroom.
He was an exception.
Yeah.
I think we're out of time.
Are we at the end, or do we have a